Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the biblical case against inflation when we return. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper, stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit, credit cards, debt, and usury. Now, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and that of clad coin and currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real world, out here in the competitive marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power and a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money over gold and silver coin. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property and property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. Those politicians and government bureaucrats knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that if they were going to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property and destroy their property rights. So if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. Now let me teach you how to do just that. My business school is now on compact disc for adult home school. For more information about my private business school, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Now, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now. The number, 417-273-4967. Now, the business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send an email request for your free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Bellevue University's Economics Department, Judd Patton, Ph.D., wrote an article in June 1983 called "The Biblical Case Against Inflation." Freeman readers since 1946 have come to understand that inflation is an increase in the quantity of money issued by government. Inflation is emphatically not higher prices. Higher prices for goods and services are one of the inevitable consequences of inflation. And they've come to understand that the U.S. dollar is not based on the principle of "In God We Trust," but rather it is premised on "In Government We Trust," and the dollar is Caesar's money, hardly godly or biblical in any regard. Now, Henry Hazlitt has put his finger on the ultimate problem. He said, "Inflation is itself an immoral act on the part of government. When modern governments inflate their currency by increasing the paper money supply, directly or indirectly, they do in principle what kings once did when they clipped the coins. Diluting the money supply with paper is the moral equivalent of diluting the milk supply with water. So very few understand Hazlitt's three sentences. And the vast majority of contemporary economists certainly do not understand Hazlitt's three sentences, and most continue to expound this supposed virtue of an elastic supply of paper money and credit in solving all of our economic ills. They frequently argue among themselves over the rate of expansion, while the more conservative economists among them prefer to expand the money supply more steadily and smoothly. None of these economists wish to halt paper money altogether. Fewer people still recognize the morality, or should it be said, the immorality of inflation. Indeed, the morality of economic actions in general, and of inflation in particular, continues to be the missing dimension of economic science and analysis. Very few people today understand that the economic world is governed by spiritual laws, laws that come from the Bible, laws that come from God. It is the purpose of this article to articulate the morality or missing dimension of inflation. The biblical case against inflation is that inflation is a sin. Sin is the transgression of the law. It violates the commandments of God, and since sin is the transgression of the law, as we see in 1 John 3, verse 4, and the wages of sin is death, we see that in Romans 6, verse 23, then should we think it a thing to be surprising that the dollar and the currencies around the world are dying? Now, only this spiritual side of inflation reveals the real cause of the world's seemingly intractable disease, and only it reveals the lasting solution to inflation. So let's take a look at biblical money. Throughout the Bible, money is shown to be a certain weight of either gold, silver, copper, or brass. A few references to these money items will suffice to establish this fact. Jeremiah the prophet bought a field from his uncle's son, and he weighed out to him the money as 17 shekels of silver. We read that in Jeremiah 32, verse 9. Now, as a shekel was a little less than 1/2 troy ounce, this was about 8 ounces of silver. Joseph, back in ancient Egypt, was sold by his brothers for 20 shekels of silver. You'll read that in Genesis 37, verse 28. King David used both gold and silver. He bought a threshing floor, some oxen, and implements for 50 shekels. 50 shekels amounts to about 2 pounds of silver. You'll see that in 2 Samuel chapter 24, verse 24. But for the mountain upon which the threshing floor was located, Mount Moriah, he paid 600 shekels, that's 26 1/2 pounds of gold, in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 25. In the New Testament, the prophecy that the Messiah would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, which was cited from Zechariah 11, verse 12, was in fact fulfilled when Judas Iscariot did in fact receive 30 silver coins, each one a shekel in weight, as reported by Matthew in Matthew 26, verses 15 and Matthew 27, verse 3. Coins had replaced the equal arm weighing balance. Lastly, notice please the use of all three commodities as monies. and provide neither gold nor silver nor copper in your money belt. You'll read that in Matthew 10, verse 9, when Jesus sent his disciples out to teach. He told them not to take any money. And the money was identified as gold, silver, and copper. Now, there's a biblical definition for inflation, and God requires that all commercial and financial transactions be made in terms of honest weights and measures. God himself, therefore, defined precise units of account for length, for weight, and for volume transactions in Ezekiel 45, verses 9 through 12. And he commanded further, quote, "You shall do no injustice in judgment in measurement of length, weight, or volume," in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. He even promised the blessing of long life for obedience to his standards. You'll read that in Deuteronomy 25, verse 15. However, use of the equal arm weighing balance permitted three basic ways that a merchant could defraud another person. First of all, one could rig the balance itself. Or two, he could use stones or weights that are not the inscribed weight. Or three, he could weigh out a debased money mixed with inferior metals against a legitimate weight, such as our clad coinage here in the United States. But God made it abundantly clear that for all who do such things and for all who behave unrighteously are an abomination to the Eternal, your God. He said that in Deuteronomy 25, verse 16. Also take a look at Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 15, Proverbs 11, verse 1, and Proverbs 16, verse 11. Since righteousness is defined as keeping the commandments, as we read in Psalms 119, verse 172, falsifying the balance of monetary debasement is an unrighteous, fraudulent act outlawed by the Eighth Commandment against stealing. And God outlawed monetary debasement, commonly called inflation, and any other form of it by the Ten Commandments. And yet the Bible records numerous references for our benefit about the unheeding Israelites. They suffered the effects of higher prices by dishonesty, increasing the quantity of money. Notice in Isaiah 1, verse 22. It says, "Your silver has become dross, your wine mixed with water." Now, dross is the scum on the surface of molten metal. By ignoring God's directives, the Israelites had resorted to the fraudulent activity of mixing their silver money with inferior metals, thus increasing the supply of money dishonestly and increasing the prices accordingly through inflation. Now, the prophets Amos and Micah record scathing indictments. First of all, "Hear this, you who swallow up the needy and make the poor of the land fail, making the ephah, that your grain measure, small, and the shekel large by debasing the money so more of it was needed to buy a given product, thereby causing consumers to pay higher shekel prices, falsifying the balances by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Even all of the bad or the inferior wheat," in Amos 8, verses 4 through 6. In Micah 6, verses 10 and 11, we read, "Are there yet the treasures of wickedness, inflation, and or fraudulent gains in the house of the wicked? And the short measure, that is an abomination, shall I count pure those with the wicked balances and with the bag of deceitful weights?" Now it is possible to understand James 5, verse 3, where it says, "Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you, and will eat your flesh like fire." Gold and silver do not rust. Now, could James be referring to such severe monetary debasement, such as hyperinflation, that the whole society is brought down very low? Read verses 1 through 3. It seems crystal clear that this biblical definition of inflation is monetary debasement. Notice one final reference to inflation in Haggai 1, verses 6 and 7, where it says, "And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider your ways." What an apt analogy to describe the effects of inflation. A bag with holes. And with a purchasing power of 14 cents of the 1940 dollar, 3.5 cents of the 1930 dollar. It should be blatantly obvious that the dollar is holy. Not holy. It's H-O-L-E-L-Y. Caesar's monies are inflated. God's money is not. Now the consequences of breaking the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. The eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, is the basis of all property and property rights. If we didn't have a law that said thou shalt not steal, we couldn't own, have, or possess personal, private property. And now what we have replaced thou shalt not steal with is from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. Inflation is a sin. It breaks the eighth commandment by stealing or defrauding others. It's analogous to the activity of a counterfeiter. Morally, monetary debasement is fraudulent, whether legalized by government or not. Now, there are many evil consequences to this practice. The most visible, devastating economic effects include, first of all, the generally higher prices in goods and services, that is what the public confusingly labels as inflation. And two, it creates a redistribution of income and wealth from the real producers of that wealth to the inflation recipients. And three, the ups and downs in business activity known as the business cycle. So let's look at these consequences one at a time. First of all, we need to point out that monetary debasement is no longer limited in the 20th century to mixing less valuable or inferior metals into gold or silver. Remember our silver coins prior to 1965? Do you remember coin clipping? Rather, today, modern-day monetary dilution or debasement occurs when governments increase their money supplies, which includes currency and coin, checking accounts and savings accounts, loans from banks, beyond their stock or gold, or of gold and silver in the bank, or in Fort Knox, or wherever the government may keep it. Now, both in principle and effects, this expansion of Caesar's money is equivalent to actual money debasement, as it necessarily victimizes some individuals from others. Now, modern-day inflation does not represent, nor does it coincide with the production of real goods and services. Thus, this additional money, when spent by the recipients, will tend to bid up prices of the commodities and services demanded, and as a result, prices will rise. But these prices do not rise uniformly. Furthermore, as inflation permeates, or as inflation works its way throughout the economy, the first recipients will benefit the most. So as a result, the distribution or ownership of wealth is altered in the absence of inflation. Income and wealth accrue, at least in a free market, to those who produce them. But God demands righteous dealings in the marketplace, as we see in Jeremiah 17, verse 10, and Revelation 22, verses 12. Inflation redistributes income in a manner unrelated to a person's economic contribution to that production. Another aspect of the unrighteous redistribution of income due to inflation concerns creditor-debtor relationships. Inflation tends to benefit debtors at the expense of creditors. Debtors can pay off their loans in depreciated money. Moreover, if inflation becomes a continuous government policy, creditors will endeavor to reduce their gifts to the debtors through higher interest rates. These higher interest rates will then tend to retard long-term capital investment and capital formation, thereby lowering the standard of living of the entire society in comparison to what it would have been in the absence of the inflation-induced higher interest rates. Such are some of the major effects of violating the Eighth Commandment. Inflation is hardly a means to love your neighbor as yourself, as the Messiah instructed us in Mark 12, verse 31. Now, what is this business cycle? Well, most theft, like the successful counterfeiter, requires misrepresentation. The counterfeiter and his fraudulent bills pass as genuine bills. Similarly, and biblically, inflation also bears false witness. It is not what it appears to be. Inflation clearly violates the Ninth Commandment in Exodus 20, verse 16, while simultaneously breaking the Eighth Commandment, which says, "Thou shalt not steal." The false witness manifests itself initially through interest rates and then into the whole price structure as the newly created money enters into the loan market, known economically as credit expansion. Interest rates are forced lower than the real market conditions would warrant. These artificial, falsified rates then mislead entrepreneurs in their calculations as to which projects, which processes, which products and technologies would be profitable. Now, a brief economic principle lesson seems necessary at this point. The economic problem of any society is to coordinate the plans and purposes of its individual members into an overall integrated production network. The decisions of the entrepreneur producers must mesh with the decisions of other producers and obviously with consumer wants. In the market, it is the price system, along with profit and loss, that performs this essential communication. Only through market reflecting and market clearing prices can any economy be fitly joined together, as we read in Ephesians 4, verse 16. Interest rates, as an integral part of the price system, synchronizes the whole production order from the raw material suppliers to the manufacturers to the retailers and finally to you, the consumer. Unlike any price, interest rates must be free to tell the truth. Market conditions must either be reflected in their movements or else shortages and surpluses will inevitably result. The plans and purpose of market participants will only be molded together to the extent that interest rates reflect supply and demand conditions that exist in the real world. Now let's go back to the business cycle. Credit expansion appears to increase the supply of savings being spent into the market. This greater supply of monetary savings, not real savings, will lower interest rates lower than they otherwise should have been. And in its absence, entrepreneurs would have faced higher market interest rates, which entailed different production decisions. Therefore, the artificial rates discoordinate or desynchronize entrepreneurial production plans from consumer spending saving preferences. The result of all of this is that entrepreneurs are then led to believe the market desires more production of a particular product later through greater savings, when in fact this is not the case. Therefore, the entrepreneurs embark upon some production plans that eventually will prove to be unsustainable and unprofitable. This is the classic boom and bust business cycle. Nowhere is the crux of the economic problem of the business cycle more aptly described than by Ludwig von Mises. He said, quote, "The whole entrepreneurial class is, as it were, in the position of a master builder whose task it is to erect a building out of a limited supply of building materials. If this man overestimates the quantity of the available supply, he drafts a plan for the execution of which the means at his disposal are not sufficient. He oversizes the groundwork and the foundations, and then only discovers later, to his dismay, in the process and progress of the construction, that he lacks the material needed for the completion of the structure. It is obvious that our master builder's fault was not overinvestment, but rather it's an inappropriate employment of the means, land, labor, and capital that was at his disposal." Interestingly enough, the business cycle is described in a similar fashion in Luke 14, verse 28. Where it says, "For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see begin to mock him." Now, the essence of the business cycle should now be very clear. Inflation or credit expansion breaks the ninth commandment and thereby causes market entrepreneurs to miscount or misjudge the real cost of their towers or investments. Market conditions do not warrant many of these projects. There is insufficient land, labor, and capital available to complete all production. Malinvestments necessarily will be made, and consequently, there must be an inevitable readjustment period. We call these inflations and recessions and depressions. They will require a recession or depression to liquidate these distortions generated by the credit expansion and so restore coordination and economic harmony. The recession is in reality the healing phase where the errors caused by the interest rate deception are purged from the economy. Well, is it any wonder a painful, high unemployment readjustment period then is absolutely necessary? Failure to count the cost accurately leads to a cluster of business errors, causing the whole production order to be out of joint or discoordinated, no longer fitly joined together, as we see in Ephesians 4, verse 16. This bust or recession constitutes the painful means to restore, fit, and synchronize the economy once again. False witness bears bitter fruit. Well, we got to take a little pause right here and give you a couple of reminders. This article, by the way, written by Dr. Judd W. Patton, originally written in June 1983, published by Bellevue University's Economics Department. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The website, the Law Hour website, that is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. www.theliberty.org. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right, again, we are reviewing a treatise by Dr. Jed W. Patton entitled The Biblical Case Against Inflation, Bellevue University's Economics Department, June 1983. Well, according to James 2, verse 10, for whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he's guilty of all. In other words, all of the Ten Commandments are interrelated. Inflation, by violating the Eighth and Ninth Commandments on stealing and false witness, reacts and relates to each of the other in the Ten Commandments. Howard Kirshner has astutely observed this relationship. He said, throughout history, periods of sound money with little or no inflation have been marked by moral advance and prosperity. Conversely, periods of unsound money have been accompanied by moral decline, and it might be noted as well that unsound money has been accompanied by economic stagnation, known better today as stagflation. Debasement of the monetary system in ancient Rome was one of the five causes of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, reported by Edward Gibbon back in 1776. Debasement of the money. Just exactly what we're doing in America today. Now, why should this be so? Well, the answer is that inflation, especially continuous inflation, leads individuals in their effort to cope with the effects of inflation to disregard all of God's Ten Commandments. The principle involved is that a little bit of leaven leavens the whole lump. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6. The sin of inflation, the inflation sin of our leaders, impacts upon all of the rest of our society. Just look it up in Isaiah 9, verse 16. Such a society becomes a get-oriented, a selfish, criminal oriented and unrighteous society in their dealings and their actions. Immoral actions do not generate prosperity, but rather immoral actions generate poverty. Henry Hazlitt describes it this way. He said, inflation tends to demoralize those who gain it even more than those who lose by it. The gainers become used to an unearned increment. They want to keep their relative gains in Matthew 6, verse 24. The profiteers from inflation tend to spend freely, frivolously, ostentatiously, and this increases the resentment of those who have been less favored. And Hazlitt concludes by saying that inflation makes it possible for some people to get rich by speculation and windfall instead of by hard work. Inflation rewards gambling and penalizes thrift. Inflation conceals and encourages waste and inefficiency in production. Inflation promotes speculation, gambling, squandering, luxury, envy, resentment, discontent, corruption, crime, and increasing drift toward more intervention, wage and price controls, which ultimately ends in dictatorship. Now let's consider how inflation, by violating the Ten Commandments, and the commandments in particular against stealing and false witness, produces a chain reaction with God's eight other commandments. First, it seems axiomatic that stealing must begin as covetousness, a violation of the 10th commandment. Covetousness is prohibited in Exodus 20, verse 17. Further, those who steal, lie, and covet necessarily have elevated the self above God, thereby violating the first and second commandments that we see in Exodus 20, verses 3 through 6. And indeed, inflation can only come into existence by a rebellion against God, ignoring God and His immutable spiritual laws, as we read in Mark 12, verse 30. And those responsible for inflating have put another God in preference to, or in place of, the God of creation, the God of the Scripture. This chain reaction continues as the victims of inflation find it easier, given their deteriorating circumstances, to travel on God's holy time, the Sabbath, in Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. And contrary to God's instruction, the fourth commandment is no longer remembered. Notice this attitude in Amos 8, verse 5. Inflation victims may even wonder why God has forsaken them, perhaps even cursing Him or using His name in vain, prohibited by Exodus 20, verse 7. Inflation dishonors our God in heaven, hence the fifth commandment is broken, as we read in Exodus 20, verse 12. And moreover, inflation also tends to dishonor one's physical parents as well. By consuming savings and pensions, inflation destroys the hopes, the lifelong dreams, and plans for financial security and economic independence. What a degrading way to end your latter years as a financial liability, dependent on others or dependent upon your children, when you should have been able to enjoy the fruit of your life's efforts. Frankly, God desires a good man to be able to leave an inheritance to his children's children. That's your grandchildren, as we read in Proverbs 13, verse 22. Today, we find that our elderly are on welfare or placed into institutions. This squandering, waste, and impoverishment generated by credit expansion will tend to weaken family ties, as mothers will be forced to seek employment outside the home to maintain the family standard of living. Today, 80% of American women are now working in the workplace. Children subsequently lose the indispensable training in right values that they need from their parents, and particularly their mothers. This lack of training may encourage, among other things, general permissiveness and violation of the seventh commandment against adultery, as we see in Exodus 20, verse 14. And finally, as noted previously, inflation promotes resentment, envy, and discontentment. As a result, individuals break the spiritual intent of the sixth commandment against murder, even if they do not commit the overt act prohibited by Exodus 20, verse 13. And through inflation, the credit expansion, a society will be induced to break all 10 commandments, but only a nation that obeys God and keeps His commandments will be blessed with economic prosperity. So says Psalms 33, verse 12. And that's why periods of sound money, sound, honest money, are periods of economic prosperity, while inflationary periods are marked by moral and economic decline, crime, stagnation, and poverty. Well, what is the optimum quantity of money? The purpose of this article has been to reveal the missing dimension or spiritual side of money and inflation. The conclusion thus far is that any monetary debasement, which includes any increase in government fiat money, that is, currency, or its substitutes, checking accounts and loans by bank, is an immoral act condemned by the law of God. And the penalty brings many economically counterproductive consequences. And yet, many may have wondered if the quantity of money must remain fixed forevermore. The answer to that is no. Under the law of God, commodity money is like any other desired good. Its production will be governed by the expected profitability in producing it. But society never needs to be concerned about the supply of its monetary metals. No regulatory authority like the Federal Reserve System is needed to manage gold and silver coin. The optimum quantity of money is whatever exists in society by the expedient of supply and demand. With a relatively small quantity of money in existence, an ounce of gold would be very valuable. That is, prices of goods would be very low. Conversely, a greater supply of money will lower the unit value of the gold. Prices of goods will be higher. What this means is that the price structure adapts itself to the quantity of money in existence. Indeed, that is why inflation causes higher prices. This does not mean, however, that trade and economic growth will somehow be hindered. Just the opposite is the case. Without credit expansion and its malinvestments, capital formation and productivity will be enhanced greatly. As long as prices are free to adjust to market conditions, trade and employment can expand without any practical limit. With rising productivity, goods prices will generally tend to decline. This will then signal more gold production, which tends to counterbalance or stabilize the overall price structure. Commodity money production does not violate any scriptural laws. Gold or silver production does not entail any redistribution of income or wealth to non-producers. Gold producers receive their income by producing a product, gold, just like the producer of any other goods or services. Further, an increase in the available money supply, that is gold and silver, will not falsify interest rates, and any new money saved and invested in the loan market reflects consumer preferences. No discoordination, no falsification, therefore no business cycle is ever generated. Now, the missing dimension of economic phenomena is that the success of economic activities are governed by the spiritual realm. Economic actions are always human actions, and the latter are always subject to right and wrong. Right and wrong is determined by the creator of the universe. Mankind must eventually come to understand this relationship if the curse of inflation that now engulfs the world, and for that matter, other economic curses, is ever to be resolved. Inflation is wrong. Inflation is evil. Inflation breaks God's spiritual laws. God's laws govern the universe, as we see in Hebrews 1, verse 3, and God has revealed that economic prosperity depends upon spiritual obedience to these laws, as we see in Deuteronomy 30, verses 15 through 20. Now, since inflation, as has now been shown, violates or leads to the violation of all Ten Commandments, it follows, therefore, that inflation will, in fact, produce anything but economic prosperity. The real problem with inflation is spiritual or moral in nature, and only economic analysis that has a biblical foundation, what may be called biblical economics, can generate this knowledge and understanding. The economics of inflation is really very simple. Don't print more money. Return to a full gold coin standard. Pull the plug on printing presses. Yet our analysis makes it plain that a real lasting solution must recognize the immortality of inflation and the immorality of inflation. The immortality of inflation is caused by man's greed. The immorality of inflation is, in fact, the violation of God's Ten Commandments. The problem then is basically twofold to establish a lasting solution. First, the foundation or paradigm of modern-day economic theory must be shown to the proponents to be erroneous. Man's reasoning as a sole source of knowledge of right and wrong, known as humanism, must be shown and proved to be woefully deficient in its ability to grasp real economic relationships of cause and effect. Modern economic science has ascribed to the Adam and Eve prerogative that we read in Genesis 3 verse 5, like Adam and Eve, they have taken to themselves the right to determine the knowledge of what is good and what is evil. They do not believe God. They do not believe that God's Word is the foundation of all knowledge. This humanistic, carnal mind is hostile to God, as we read in Romans 8, verse 7. It is not subject to the laws of God, and therefore it cannot come to the knowledge of the relationship between spiritual and economic events. Its foundation will not permit the discovery of economic truth. Indeed, to suggest to the scientific economic community today that their research must be grounded on the Bible would undoubtedly be greeted with incredulity, sarcasm, scorn, and howls of laughter. But to the humanistic individual, God says that there is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Proverbs 14:12. Inflation under humanistic direction will ultimately accelerate to hyperinflation and the death of the money. In a humanistic framework, man becomes God and government becomes his agency to manage money and the economy. They experiment and they choose like Adam and Eve. Those theories that have the greatest predictive power or highest statistical correlation. And it's based on these facts that they endeavor to formulate right and wrong policy outside any ethical deliberations or outside the Ten Commandments. The second and more closely related problem, even if the world's economists could be convinced, is that a majority of people must come to grasp that the inflation problem is indeed a moral problem. A humanistic society will never tolerate godly money, and they will undoubtedly want some form of paper money. The unholy bag of inflation can be patched up only when the biblical paradigm replaces secular humanism as public policy. And frankly, the outlook for that happening is not good, to say the least. But there is good news ahead. God has promised that at some future date that He would put His laws into our hearts and minds, in Hebrews 10, verse 16. So until that day, those that do have the understanding ought to profess it to those who have ears to hear, and to live it by not demanding our share of Caesar's money from Caesar, but rather we should use gold and silver coin, as the Scripture demands. Now that report comes from the Bellevue University Economics Department, The Biblical Case Against Inflation by Dr. Judd W. Patton. Well, the problem with money here in the United States, and indeed I suppose we could say worldwide, I guess we ought to understand modern money. To understand our modern monetary system requires some preliminary economic knowledge. First, as a fixed principle, all good economic reasoning starts from barter. And once the hunter-gatherer stage of human history was over, there was goods for other goods, exchanges or barter. And along with the barter came trade with other regions, as can be seen from the trade in amber, which came mainly from the Baltic and was bartered as far away as Egypt and even China. There was also lending and debt. It is the bane of the archaeologist in present-day Iraq to come across ancient cuneiform clay tablets only to read something as mundane as a record that one party owes 3 days of plowing and 8 bags of grain to the party on the other side of the transaction. This may be boring, but it shows that there was credit and debt long before there was any money. And the problem is that goods-for-goods transactions are very clumsy, and it took many transactions, each involving a more widely desired good, before people could actually succeed in trading their goods for something that they wanted. Then some people started to realize that these easier-to-trade goods had similar characteristics, and they started to acquire these goods, not to consume, but to use to make further trades easier, and over time they discovered that these goods were valuable as a medium of exchange. Through centuries of trial and error, they discovered indirect exchanges, and they discovered money, and they also discovered the good most useful as money was gold. Now, gold and silver was given to us by God Himself to use as money, as a medium of exchange. Well, 25 years of monetary history, let's take a look at. In strict monetary terms, the early coin economies were cash currency economies, and each person held a stock of cash in coin form. When the stock got too low, they sold some goods. When it got too high, they bought some other goods. The point to note here is that with a nearly unchanged stock of coin, there could be no price inflation. That would have required the discovery of some new gold or silver mine. But there could be price deflation. That could happen if people decided that they wanted to hold more cash in hand because, for example, there were rumors of war. Having more money in hand than before naturally meant that there was less to be offered for the goods in the market. So if the stock of goods had not changed or changed very little, then most money prices for goods would fall. Paper money has been in circulation in China for over 1,000 years. The idea of paper money was brought back to the West by Marco Polo in the 11th century. For most of its Western history, all circulating paper money has had inscribed upon it a version of pay to the bearer on demand. Early paper money was issued by banks and became known as banknotes. These notes normally worked very well because any holder could go into the issuing bank, present the note, and then leave with the coined money. But over time, more and more bankers discovered that their notes were never returned to them all at once. They simply circulated in the economy, working just as well as the coined money did, and from there it was a simple step to decide to issue more notes than they had coin to cover them. And from that point, the cost of the notes was the cost of the ink and paper, and the issuance of the notes was by the way of new loans. The bankers had now discovered fractional reserve banking. Now, if all or even most of the note holders showed up to exchange the notes for the money, that is, the gold coin, there was no way the banks could honor them. These excess issuance of notes had a further effect. As they were sent into circulation, they acted on the economy as though there was more money than actually existed. This then led to the checking account. Now, the checking account served to move the monetary inflation safely in-house inside the banks. Paper money is very visible. Wholesalers and retailers quickly see an increase in quantity, and they act to raise the selling prices of their goods before the prices of the goods they have go way up. Bankers and other lenders needed a solution to this. So in the 19th century, they found it. Instead of issuing new loans in the form of paper notes to new borrowers, they started to do so by crediting the borrower's checking account. That way, they could ensure that this was not an unseemly additional amount of newly printed money to be seen on the streets. The economic effects were the same, boom and bust. The best example of this historically is the U.S. false boom from 1921 to 29. U.S. interest rates were artificially held down by the Federal Reserve. The market became a national craze, and brokers themselves borrowed vast quantities of money, which they then relent to their customers so that they could buy shares in the stock market. Speculation. Well, the United States and its paper dollar still stands at the center of all of this, though the European Union now stands in the wings with its own version of a global currency. The United States stands as a grotesque example of a pure credit money system. Now, this is a monetary system without a vestige or a trace of hard currency, a remnant to act as an emergency monetary foundation, as was the case, bogus, not covered by gold paper issued by the early bankers. A U.S. dollar is a Federal Reserve note. We haven't learned anything, boys and girls, from history. We haven't learned anything from the Bible. We haven't learned anything from God or Moses. We've been instructed. In fact, in 1690, Massachusetts issued 7,000 pounds of printed bills of equal value with money. As a result, almost immediately, all coin then in Massachusetts was exported to England, and a new stock followed as fast as it came in from abroad. Trade and commerce declined, and hard times came upon the people. The next development of the colonial system of paper money was a partial repudiation and recognition of the evils of such a practice. The people of South Carolina had already recorded their sense of their mistake in the statute of the 11th of December 1717, in which they said, quote, "It is found by experience that the multiplicity of the bills of credit hath been the cause of the ruin of our trade and commerce, and hath been in the great evil of this province, and that it ought with all expedition to be remedied." Well, the War for Independence exhibited a new development of this system of credit by the reckless disregard of its bounds. Promises of money were scattered over the land alike by the states and by the United States until bills, to use the words of John Adams, second president of the United States, became as plenty as oak leaves. The paper currency of the Congress was printed in such exorbitant amounts that wages and prices skyrocketed, forcing the legislature to enact harsh wage and price controls. And when these failed, moral-sounding laws reeking of piety and patriotism were enacted in an attempt to chain the people under penalty of violence to the government's absurd money, such as the statute that said, "If any person shall hereafter be so lost of all virtue and regard for his country as to refuse to accept its notes, such person shall be deemed an enemy of his country." Gosh, that sounds like being branded a terrorist today. Well, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. Well, there's the signal. It says time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.